Blog Talk Radio.
All right, you're listening to Show Talk with Angela Butler. Today, the interview is with Mr. Daryl Ricardo Matthews. How are you doing this afternoon, Mr. Matthews?
Doing just fine, just fine.
That is wonderful. How are you handling COVID?
Trying to be cautious because there are people around me who have depressed immunization systems. And I'm trying to be very responsible and responsive to their needs because I know that there are some people in my family that if they're exposed, it would be almost a death sentence, if not an actual death sentence for them. So I'm trying to do the prudent things and look out for public safety.
Oh, okay. All right. So does anyone you know, has anyone you know contracted COVID-19?
I know people who have been exposed and had to go on quarantine because they were exposed. I'm not sure if anyone has contracted it. I know some people who've gotten sick and gone to the hospital, but they don't tell, you know, they don't tell you the status or they don't publicize it. So I can't be sure if I know or not, but I know people, who, like I said, who have been exposed, gotten notifications on their jobs. They've had to shut down offices and clean them out, sometimes several times, the same building. So it's out here, and it's not a joke. It's a real thing.
Yes, sir, COVID-19 years. You are the partnership specialist at U.S. Department of Commerce Economic Development Administration. Is that in Atlanta, Georgia?
Well, it is nationwide, but I am based out of Atlanta.
You are based out of Atlanta, but it's nationwide? Okay.
Yes.
So basically, what do you do? I know you're highly respected.
Well, currently, we just finished the decennial census for 2020. As a partnership specialist, I'm part of a team, I'll even go as far as to say an elite team, who is responsible for developing relationships with partners, whether it's universities, whether it's with the congressional offices, local governments, Indian tribes, tribal governments, a number of constituents that we build relationships with to help us to determine the head count. So the census is taken every 10 years. So it is a temporary position that will come to an end. My tour of duty will end sometime in 2021. But since we've just finished with the actual enumeration, now we're going into another phase of the campaign, which I'll be in training week after next to for them to give us our new marching orders. But for the last year and a half, I'm involved in the community, encouraging people who are the trusted voices of their community to come on board with us and to help us encourage the residents in their community to complete the census, because, you know, the census determines the actual voting strength or the representation in your communities. But more importantly, census data determines how money's out of the federal system. You know, we all pay taxes. Well, those taxes are put in a large pot and then divvied out into communities, not based on the fact that you feel like you need money to do things, but based on the census numbers. Those are the numbers to justify the returns that you get to your community in terms of dollars. And we have communities that we call hard to count, our lower self-response rate areas, our low response rate areas, and usually those are communities of people of color. For whatever reason, we don't connect that the census is one of our civic responsibilities and is just as important as voting. But more importantly, in our communities, you know, you see neighborhoods, neighboring counties where they're building new schools, building, improving roads, building hospitals. Those communities generally have a 70-80% self-response rate to the census, that they understand that the monies that they get back into their community are based on having a good or an accurate head count. In many of our communities of color, we have people saying things like, I don't want the government to know my business. But yet, if you go on social media, I know more about you than the census is going to ask. You know, we're only going to ask you 9 questions. Again, just simple questions. It takes less than 10 minutes. But we've got to get our people to understand that they have a part to play in their own self-determination. And the dollars that they're looking for to build more high schools, to improve build hospitals and improve schools, to make sure the infrastructure in their communities are kept up, is based on impetus. So I've been out in the communities trying to get the folks who do business in those communities, who live in those communities, who need to thrive in those communities, to return their census questionnaires and to encourage others in their circle of influence or their sphere of influence. So that's what I've been doing for the last 18 months.
Okay. So you were also, you previously served as an independent consultant for the White House Presidential Advance Staff. Could you tell me about that?
Sure. So we see the President of the United States or the Vice President of the United States, various cabinet members, as they go into communities, whether they're campaigning or they're on official business. And those trips need to be advanced. Those trips need to be diagrammed and planned, submitted back to the White House for approval, coordinated with Secret Service, coordinated with Walker, White House Communications, and there's a lot that goes into those. When you see the President of the United States at a site, that they didn't just decide, hey, we're going to roll up on that site and let's go look at this plant or let's go visit this school. That is carefully coordinated and carefully, or it should be, and carefully executed. So I had the privilege of working primarily for President William Clinton and some, not to the same extent, for Vice President Al Gore. But you get to see a lot of that happens in your government in the backstage side. You know, like I said, things don't just appear. When you see the president walking through a certain area or if he's going up to a blackboard to write on it or to look at something, that's been scripted and, like I said, approved. And there's a method to all of the madness. Well, we also, when we get on the ground, we arrive a week ahead of the president and his team. We make sure that the facilities are adequate. We make sure that we build a set, design a set, the construction of where they're going to appear. We make sure that we have looked at every possibility for ingress and egress, that we have contracted with the proper vendors to make sure that sound, the piping drape, you know, is not going to cause a problem in terms of the camera and the press. We make sure that we set up the areas for the press, the press hole. There's just a number of things that it looks so easy when you're just looking at it on TV. It just appears to be so haphazard, or not even haphazard, but so I guess last minute. It just looks to flow, but it's not. Every step, every item has been checked and double checked, and like I said, planned a week in advance. And when you see the president leave one spot and he's headed to the next spot, team in the ground has been there a week doing the same thing that we're doing, preparing. You know, because the president, we have a mobile White House. And when the president is away from the actual White House, he's still the president, and he still has to be able to function in the unlikely event of an emergency, in the event of day-to-day business. The president still has to be able to function and have access to all of the tools that are at the White House, but on the road. So there was a lot to that. That was a very exciting part and time in my life. And it's a very valuable read on your resume. I can't tell you how many interviews I've had where just this very question has been something that made for a long conversation, a very interesting conversation. I would dare say I've gotten jobs just because I've had that White House experience and connections. So
yes, it must have really been great for your career.
It was. It's also very laborious. And I'd say it's more of a young person's game. We had great crews, though. Wherever we went, we had great crews. And our job was to make sure that when President went wheels up, when Air Force One took off, that there were no regrets. We didn't leave anything in the locker room. We took it all to the playing field because we're creating a message. You know, the president and the American public have to see their president in the best possible light. And we created the image that many times, I've still got a few newspapers where a set that I designed, that was the photo on the front, you know, above the fold. Yeah, that's what you hope to do, that you've presented the president of the United States or the vice president or the cabinet in the best possible light for the American public.
And it's safest way.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Absolutely.
So what do you think about President Trump and the way he presents himself?
Every president has their own style, their own message. The training that we did to do advance for President Clinton was a little bit different than the training that the teams did for President Obama. I've not been involved with President Trump's advance team. I couldn't even tell you who's over there, but you know, once I left the Clinton White House, I couldn't tell you who came in behind me for President Bush or for President Obama. I think every president has a method, a style that works for them. And so it's really not for me to judge. And I think this would be a good time for me to also say that I'm still currently a federal employee. So I'm under the Hatch Act, which means that I have to walk very delicately. Of course, the election is over, but I have to be very delicate in terms of what I say about the president and other elected officials that I don't get cited or someone gets confused and accuses me of being involved. And even though this is after hours and I'm not on my tour, but it is something that we're reminded constantly. Yes.
We'll move on to something else. So you were the executive director of the National Association of Black Journalists from 2014 to 2015. What did you do in that position? And also, you told me in one of our phone conversations, you've had two or three, that you like to help Black people. Could you explain to me how you do that?
Well, let me back up, because I have been the executive director of three national Black organizations. And before, the National Association of Black Journalists was the last organization that I headed up in that capacity. But in 1978, I moved from Kansas City, Missouri, where I went to undergrad school and high school. My father was stationed there. When he came back from Vietnam, he was a soldier, a consultant for STRATCOM, Strategic Air Command, out of Fort Leavenworth. So I applied for a job. I was encouraged by some mentors. And that's the first thing I have to say, is I've had some very strong, including my father, some very strong men in my life who served as mentors and still do. And it pays to have great mentors, great men as your mentors, or great women. But 1978, I had an opportunity to move to Chicago to work for my fraternity, Alpha Phi Alpha Fraternity, in their national headquarters. And I saw that as mission work, because I was, at the time, I was working as a claim, multiple line claims adjuster for USF&G, United States Fidelity and Guaranty, a national insurance company that has since been bought and merged with other insurance companies. I believe it's now part of the AIG family of insurance companies. But at the time, I was working with them, but this opportunity came along, and I saw it as, here is an organization, a fraternity, that was founded by Black men, that is sustained by the economics of Black men, of the Black community, and its purpose, its dedication, is to the development and to the building of character, to the development of leadership principles, to emphasize academic excellence. Here's an organization that sets a high bar. It's not a bar for Black folks. It's a bar that emulates the world standard of excellence. In other words, it's not an affirmative action adjusted goal, that this is an institution built for and by Black men for the perpetuation of Black men. And I wanted to be a part of that, because we don't have a lot out here to promote, sustain, nurture Black men. Matter of fact, you look on social media a lot, you see a lot of memes that still continue to denigrate and deride Black men. I'm thinking about one now that I digress for a moment, that shows a bunch of men sitting in a metro train, and there's a Black female standing, and there's no context to it, but they ask you to draw all kinds of conclusions as to what's wrong with this picture. And I encourage people, let's not buy into the psychological warfare against Black men. I ride the metro train here, the MARTA train here in Atlanta, and there have been many occasions where I've seen, and I've also offered my seat to someone, whether it's a woman or an older person, and sometimes they're getting off at the next stop, which is just seconds away, and they'll say, no, that's okay, I'm getting off at the next stop. But no, some of us find it necessary to take pot shots, to put things out here that are negative toward Black men, and we just join forces with those who historically have considered us only three-fifths of a man, which is a whole other story. It goes back to the census in the 1800s. But so I saw this as an opportunity to really highlight and elevate the image of Black men and their aspirations. So I was I worked in their headquarters for a number of years. And subsequently, sir, I started out as a junior level staff person, met a lot of people who weren't so great, but taught me that you have to be able to deal with people at every level. And some people have, everybody doesn't think the same way you think. So there's a diversity of thought, even among black people. We're not myopic. We all, don't all think and vote the same way. But there's a dichotomy, a diversity there. So I subsequently left there to become the executive director of the National Association of Black Accountants, which at the time was a small, not as old as the fraternity, relatively young organization of, it was a coeducational organization, I said male and female, of accountants and people and students who wanted to become CPAs or were in the field of finance and accounting. The people that were the bread and butter, the backbone of corporate America and most of our other institutions. I mean, if you have a thriving enterprise, somebody has to look out after the money. And so it was a different challenge, but it was still dedicated to black professionals and getting a toehold in the marketplace. So I spent 9 years doing that, and we achieved great success together, myself and my staff and the organization. That is a whole nother wonderful story at another time, but and they're still thriving and doing well. And I worked with a group of black accounting firm owners, the Division of Firms, which are smaller firms, but they are owned and managed by black partners, you know, and. And again, they work together. They work with larger firms, but to be a part of seeing the enterprise of industry, and then subsequently, I left there and became the executive director of the National Medical Association. Now, I should say that I tell you that I'm not a doctor. I'm not an accountant, nor was I a journalist, but the skill set taken to elevate these organizations, to keep them running smooth, doesn't take being a doctor or an accountant or a lawyer. You need a person who's got the whole ball of wax experience, who's big picture, who's a generalist. You know, my job was not to do the financial reports for the organization, but to make sure that the railroad ran on time. So in all of these organizations, I saw my role as contributing to the development of black people in their respective professions.
Okay.
And so,
all right.
In my day-to-day life, I see myself as being someone whose raison d'etre is my reason for being, is to help uplift not just black people, any and everyone, but I'm especially specifically dedicated to the uplift of the black community.
All right. I know you had said that on the phone. You had said that. So you also help people get grants, government grants. Is that which job was that? What organization was that that you help black people, not people, not just black people, but people get grants?
Well, as the executive director of any of these organizations, you are responsible for fundraising, for coordinating the fundraising, for sometimes it's based on grants, sometimes it's based on corporate partnerships. And I like to say partnerships and not benevolence or donations, not sponsorship, but corporate partnerships where you're working with a corporate partner to deliver on programs that, you know, with mutual objectives. So grants is only a part of it. A small part of it. So, yes, I've had my stab at or my interaction with grantsmanship. There are people who make a living writing grants full time. What I find all too often is people will try to come to you. You know, we don't like to pay our folks. We like to ask them to do something on the front end, and if there's something in it on the back end, then there might be something in it for you. Well, that's an insult to a professional. Yeah, if you're going to retain a grant writer, then you put them on retainer, you pay them for their time, and you pay them up front. If you bring in a grant, because I can't tell you the number of times that I've engaged in an activity like that, and then you get the money, and then people forget, or they pretend like they forget. So I thought that's important for me to say. Also, I can't tell you the number of times. I don't even listen to those overtures anymore. Where people always want you to put yourself out there. Now, I'm sure you have people who would want to advertise on your radio podcast, and then if we get some new customers or more customers or revenues go up, then I'd be willing to pay you. No, if you were going over to a general market station, you'd pay for the advertising up front and pray and hope that you got some business. But we always... seem to want to skew our business.
And I use that have them. I have people work on commission, or to sell a book, percentage, things like that, instead of just outright paying an advertising or promotional fee or sponsorship. Yes, sir. I've got that for almost 11 years.
Yeah,
it's really slow.
And I
the showdown.
You, going over to another station, a general market, or a what we call a general market, but a non-minority station, they write the check without, they'd be presented with an invoice and they write the check, or they find it, or else they wouldn't advertise. But we're always expected to lower our price or to compromise our worth, you know, and that's something that we've got. You know, part of helping black people is to get them to face the truth about our belief systems and what we believe and what we are willing to settle for, and to realize that all too often we like to think that the other folks' ice is colder, their sugar is sweeter, or that their water is wetter. We've got to start recognizing our own self-worth and demanding our value.
That is true. Sometimes black people have a tendency to use other black people.
That's right.
Yeah. That's unfortunate. Keep talking, sir.
Yeah, so your question had to do with grants and grantsmanship. I would just say that that was part of what I've had to do and monitor grants that were in existence when I got into an organization. Grants are something that can be helpful, but they're not the answer. They're not always the answer. So,
grants are not always the answers, you say?
Right.
Okay. So the executive director of the National Medical Association from 2011 to 2014, how are you able to work in that position, cultivate it like you did for over two years?
Well, you know, what was interesting is the National Medical Association was looking for an executive director. And I was approached by a search firm I had a very warm relationship with. I'd worked with them before, recommended clients to them, and again, had a great working relationship. And at the time, I was unemployed, and they came to me and told me that, look, we are doing a search for an executive director for the National Medical Association, which is black doctors, the oldest professional association in the country, established in 1895, the oldest national one. I mean, there are some others that are older than them, but they're just not national. And they said, we have to show that we cast a wide net, but they want a doctor. They're going to hire a doctor. So you're not going to get this job, so don't even, you know, think that. But we'd just like to include your resume in the candidates to show that we cast, because your experience and your background, you're more than qualified, but they just want a doctor. No problem, because I'm looking for a job, and your game is only as good as your practice. You know, I tell that to professional athletes all the time. You can tell on Sunday who didn't have a good practice through the week, because you play like you practice. So I thought, well, this would be a good time for me to spruce up my resume. I'm going to go through some interviews here. It's always good to get that real life experience to practice. So I sent my resume in, and there were 58, as I was told, there were 58 candidates. And I didn't think anything about it because I already was told I'm not going to get the job, so I had nothing to lose. So I sent my resume in, and 2 days later, I get a call from the search firm saying, congratulations, you just made the top 10. We're going to interview the top 10 candidates in Silver Spring, Maryland this weekend. Can you make arrangements to be in Silver Spring? You know, they reimbursed it and all that, but I had to clear my schedule and fly into Silver Spring, Maryland. No problem. My interview was scheduled to be at 6:00 on a Sunday evening. So you know you're not going to get that job, because 6:00 on a Sunday evening, I don't want to hear what I got to say, let alone people who've been interviewing folks all day long. So, and the last flight out of Washington is at 8:00. So I'm probably going to have to spend the extra night on my own dime, but hey, no problem. I mean, you know, it's Washington, D.C. So I go through the interview. I have nothing to lose because I'm not going to get the job. So I'm speaking very plain spoken, very forthright about issues that I've found in nonprofit organizations, issues of the alignment between the staff and the board and the disconnect. And the search executive tells me, you know, the next day, look, you're going to be called back. You just made the final, I think, final four, I believe. And you're going to get a call. And subsequently, I got a call. I had to be in Washington, D.C. that next weekend at their national conference and make a PowerPoint presentation on why I was the person to run the organization. Now, at this point, I still know that I'm not going to get the job. So I'm going in with my PowerPoint presentation that was put together by a young lady that I had invested in, a former executive assistant, and I'd sent her to train on PowerPoint. And I believe in developing people. If you hire somebody and you're not investing in their value-added skills, then you really are not doing right by them. And you could get so much more out of an employee that's more valuable. And my job, my philosophy has always been, when you get through with your service with me, you will be a much more valuable employee. Matter of fact, if I'm doing the right thing, you'll want to go. You'll be ready to go, if nothing else, to run your own organization like you've seen me, like we have run this current one. So anyway, I get in and I do my thing with the PowerPoint, and I come out of the room and I said, yes, I knew I stood into it. I knew that I punched it in. Knew I wasn't going to get the job, but I knew I had punched it in. So I'm getting ready to get on the plane to come back to Atlanta. And the search firm executive calls me at my hotel and says, can you hang around for a little bit? Sure, what's going on? Well, they're voting on the executive director, and your name has come up. Okay. So
you got the position.
Ultimately, I got the position. It took them 7 votes for them to decide. But on the 7th vote, somebody changed their vote. It was a 7-7 tie each time on the board. And I got the position. And then that begins a whole nother story. And we don't have time to go into that one today.
Okay.
But,
what about the 32nd general president, Alpha Phi Alpha fraternity? That was a little while back. Not that long ago, though.
Well, see, I had been the executive director 10 years prior to that. And usually when you're the executive director of an organization, you're looked upon as a valued team member, but you're still an employee. You're not one of the people sitting around the table making policy. Your job is to carry it out. And if you do the job right, you've probably made some enemies along the way because you've had to make some decisions. You've had to tell somebody no, and they didn't like it. You know, you probably made some enemies. There are probably some people who didn't like you from the day you showed up, because we can be like that. I don't know what he's about, but I just don't like him. I don't like her. She thinks she's cute. You know, we can be very petty. That's some stuff we're going to have to get over as a people. You know, we've got to learn that, you know, we're all on the same boat. We don't have to like the same flavor Kool-Aid. We don't have to laugh at the same drinks, but we do need to be respectful to the community, and we need to work together. So anyway, again, it was suggested that I run for that office. And to make a very long story short, over the course of a year and a half, my team and I won the election, and I got a chance to serve as a four-year term as the general president, do some really exciting things to break ground ceremonially for the Martin Luther King Memorial that's in Washington, D.C., which was an initiative of the fraternity. I got a chance to preside over our centennial, our 100th year anniversary. I had a chance to do a lot of things, but more importantly, to continue to demonstrate to the world that the world standards of excellence were the standards we were striving for, to encourage. I get emails and social media posts from young men saying that I was in high school when you were the president of the fraternity. I saw you on news. I saw you, or one of my teachers was a member of the fraternity. And, you know, I'm dedicated to improving myself and to being a leader for my community, to serve. You see, because if you're a real leader, you're a servant. You cannot lead people you're not willing to serve. You cannot just hand out edicts and mandates from on high. So when I tell you that I'm about helping people, I'm about serving people, but you can't help those who are not willing to help themselves. You can't carry people. You have to teach them self-sufficiency, the skills. You've got to inspire them to want to get over the hill, not just stand there and look at the clouds. And so that's what my whole life has been about. From a very early age, and part of that is built and based on a Christian ethos. You know, you want to do for others because it does come back to you. And I have had so much favor returned to me in my life, and not usually from the people that I've helped, but from someone else. But the people I've helped have gone on to help someone else. Pay it forward, always.
Yes, I agree with that. So I noticed on your LinkedIn page that it says, you know, that you had the passing from the brotherhood of your 25th General President, James R. Williams, Esquire.
Yes.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Well, I am too, because I mentioned how it's important to have great men and women as mentors. There's also been another person I mentioned on my LinkedIn page about 2 weeks ago. I mention him frequently, and that is Brigadier General retired Charles E. McGee, who was a Tuskegee Airman, who recently had a Congressional Gold Medal as one of the Tuskegee Airmen, a former national president, used to be the president of the Alumni Alpha Chapter in Kansas City. And he knew of me. I was an undergraduate. I used to come to the meetings and sit at the feet of these great men and listen to them debate, listen to them argue the points of parliamentary procedure. I just wanted to absorb all the knowledge I could from men that I saw were in places that I wanted to go. Our young people sometimes don't get that you may not agree with the old heads, but you got to listen to us because we've been there. We've already been there. Never take advice from somebody who hasn't been where you're trying to go. So Brother McGee asked me one day if I wanted to go with him to pick up the regional vice president who was coming to Kansas City to plan a convention. Oh, sure. So it turned out to be, at that time, he was a candidate for lieutenant governor of Ohio, black candidate for governor of Ohio. We're talking the early 70s. And it turned out to be James R. Williams. Actually, it was 1975. It turned out to be James R. Williams, who later retired as a judge. He was a federal attorney for the Northern District of Ohio, appointed by Jimmy Carter. He has been a mentor. He is the one who told me the first day he met me that I should run for elective office in the fraternity. That I had, he told me about all these great qualities that he saw in me that I didn't see in myself, because sometimes we're not brought up in an environment where we're allowed to believe in ourselves, or so many people around us are negative and putting us down. Why you think, who you think you are? Why you want to go to law school? You know, and I heard a lot of that growing up from your own family sometimes. And so he encouraged me, and because of him, I ran for my first political office within the fraternity. But I run for public office, no.
You haven't run for public office. Do you intend to?
No, I don't. I support people who run for public office. I try to help. I raise money for them. I give money to them when I am not under federal employment. I have a lot of young men that I have mentored who are out here running for public office or in public office. There's a gentleman who's the vice chair of the Democratic National Party named Mike Blake. He was a young man who, when he was in college, came up under my wing. He served in my administration as the Alpha president. There's another one who just ran for Congress. Unfortunately, he lost his race in Virginia, Dr. Cameron Webb, who also has a law degree and a medical degree. He was on the board of the National Medical Association when I got the job. Matter of fact,
it's a great and powerful fraternity that you belong to. You'll have 20 seconds, sir.
Okay.
I just wanted to say I thank you for the work that you did. For the community, the hard work that you did.
Well, and I thank you for exposing to the community and the world at large what I call unsung heroes, people who may not be in mainstream media all the time but still are out here doing it. They wake up and they do it every day. And even when they're tired, they still keep getting up and still keep doing it. And I'm just one of many that's out here, so I feel blessed, and I thank you for recognizing me today.
You're welcome, Mr. Darrell Ricardo Matthews, and you're welcome to come back on Show Talk with Angela Butler anytime. Thank you for taking the time to tell people about your career and also about the help you have given people.
Well, it's my pleasure.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you.
Too. Thank you, sir.
Talk to you again soon, I'm sure.
Yes, sir.
All
Thank
right.
you.
Sure.